This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Biofuels may be doing more harm than good if we don't plant and harvest them correctly. That's the disturbing message from two studies out in the journal Science this week that take a closer look at biofuels and their ecological impacts. Biofuels are made from products like corn, soybeans, or palm trees. The reason to shift to biofuels and away from fossil fuels was in part to cut down on greenhouse gas emissions. But these two papers in Science say we might be doing just the opposite. By cutting down forests or savannas to grow fuel, we might actually be increasing the carbon we put into the air. And by using corn or palm oil for fuel, we are forcing more natural habitat to be turned into farmland. This hour, we're going to take a closer look at the debate over biofuels. Is one better or worse in terms of greenhouse gases? And should we be using food crops like corn to provide our fuel? Because there appear to be better alternatives that are in the early stages of development that have not received much attention. For example, have you heard about algae and bacteria? Bacteria that can take waste products, even garbage, and efficiently and effectively turn them into oil or alcohol. Are these viable alternatives? Well, they apparently must be doing something right, because oil giant Chevron and car giant GM have bought up pieces of some companies doing this kind of work. What do they know that we don't know? That's what we hope to find out, at least part of that, this hour. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com or over to Second Life and find the Science Friday Island over there, where we'll take your questions from your avatar and get a T-shirt also. Let me introduce my guests. Daniel Kamen is the Class of 35 Distinguished Professor of Energy at UC Berkeley. He's also co-director of the Berkeley Institute of the Environment and the founding director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Lab there. He joins us from San Francisco. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dan.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. David Tillman is Regents Professor and the McKnight Presidential Chair in Ecology at the University of Minnesota. He's also director of Cedar Creek Natural History Area. He is spending a sabbatical year at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and that's where he joins us today. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Tillman.
My pleasure to be here and to actually be back again, too.
That's good for you. Thank you. Biofuels don't have to come from plants in the ground. We'll talk about that when we talk about algae later. But let's talk about your headline today in the New York Times, which says, studies deem biofuels a greenhouse threat. There's one from the Wall Street Journal that say biofuels may worsen emissions. Is that the takeaway message from your study?
Well, I think there are two messages. One, as we learn more about biofuels, it turns out there are more ways than we initially imagined to do them poorly. And that's the headline news, I guess, is that there are ways to do them poorly. But we also know there are some ways to make biofuels that can give society the two advantages we need, gaining new energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So I think, this, in my mind, the story has two parts. I think it's a good time to have it come out, because the industries for second-generation biofuels are just getting off the ground. And I think our report and the other report that came out can help steer industries toward the right kind of biomass and waste product source to give the benefits that society needs.
What do these new studies pick up about the use of land and the release of carbon dioxide that other studies have missed?
Well, the study that we were involved in looked at all of the ways that current biofuels are causing land conversion around the world, the conversion of rainforest to grow palm nut oil, rainforest to grow soybeans, native grasslands for corn, for corn ethanol, or for sugarcane ethanol, and so on. And what it turns out is that these native ecosystems in the vegetation and soils contain so much carbon that when they are cut down and plowed, the release of greenhouse gases exceeds greatly the benefits that those biofuels offer. It's a half a century up to four centuries before you even hit the break-even point, where you wouldn't have been better off just burning gasoline than burning those kinds of biofuels. Now, the other study was to me a very surprising and important insight. It said that even if you use existing farmland to grow biofuels, because the whole global agriculture is joined together by the markets and market prices, that when you pull fertile land out of food crops and put it into biofuels, someone else around the world has to make up for that to meet the needs of human society for food. And when they do that, they often take food out of native land out of native ecosystems, releasing the carbon that was in the vegetation and soil to the air, and causing an indirect greenhouse gas.
Mm-hmm.
And so the net effect of these is that for many of the ways of the sort of the first generation biofuels, a lot of them made out of food crops that we are making right now, that it seems like it's very unlikely that we could expand biofuel production in that way and have any greenhouse gas benefit.
What about some of the feedstocks that are not food crops, like switchgrass or willow trees, things like that?
Well, those are very good feedstocks. The perennial crops like the long-life grasses and the woody plants have many advantages, but it's critically important what land we grow them on. If we grow them on very fertile land, and by doing so cause someone else to clear native ecosystems and release that carbon, we aren't ahead in the game for greenhouse gases. But there are many crops, including switchgrass, that can grow on less fertile land, the kind of land that farmers in the United States and farmers around the world quit farming because they just couldn't make a profit on it.
Mm-hmm.
But our work suggests there are 1.2 billion acres of that kind of land that's already been farmed, already had its carbon dioxide and so on released to the air, some of which, we don't know how much, some of which would be viable for growing biofuels. And we think we should use those lands first and get that greenhouse gas benefit.
Mm-hmm. In response, the Renewable Fuels Association, as reported by the AP here, which represents ethanol producers, calls the research, is your view of land use change, quote, simplistic, and said the study, quote, fails to put the issue in context, assigning the blame for rainforest deforestation and grassland conversion to agriculture solely on the renewable fuels industry, ignores key factors that play a greater role, said Bob Dineen, the association's president. Any reaction to that?
Well, I bet he didn't read the papers, because the papers aren't so naive. I didn't write the indirect land use paper. That was written by a team from Princeton and Woods Hole and other institutions, but I've read the paper. And they use a very well-established, very well-calibrated global economic model, which looks at how global farm commodity prices influence production around the world. And based upon that model, which is really saying based upon the long-term trends that have been observed and recorded around the world, how these things really are linked together, there is an effect of converting rich farmland in the United States to biofuel production on the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Dan Kamen, when we're considering whether or not to use biofuels, we're considering a couple of things. There's energy independence, meaning coming up with a different source of energy than petroleum, and also the carbon dioxide output. Are these the two main concerns? What if we decide, you know, one is more important than the other?
Right. Well, those are two of the concerns. I also think the livelihoods of poor farmers in the U.S. and overseas are also part of the story. And I think that what Dave just told you is really the key message here. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is not very surprising, right? What these studies say, and they do document it very well, and they do use different methods, they come down to this idea of what's the carbon or ecological debt that we are extracting from the soil. And what they come down to is to say that if you have healthy, standing ecosystems, whether they're rainforests or other things, it's crazy to put pressure on them to cut them down, which is what is happening in places like the Amazon, where the boom in biofuel markets is meaning they are converting rainforest area and cerrados, kind of mixed open fields, swampy lands and other things, into producing soy and other things. That's crazy because those ecosystems provide lots of services, one of which happens to be sucking up lots of carbon. So I don't think these results are surprising. What I think is nice is that they've clearly encapsulated what seems like an obvious truth. And in fact, what they lead you to say is that in the worst case, we should use no land or very little land for biofuels until we do what we can with current waste streams. And so using municipal waste, all the garbage we put in the landfills, we can develop bugs to chew that up and make biofuels. We can also use non-crop species, the willows and things. We can also integrate biofuels into food production. And in many parts of the developing world where the land is quite degraded and we have put very little inputs into it, the prospects with other crops, sorghum and things, to get better food yields, better biofuels, and help to restore the ecosystem actually all exist. So,
but Dan, how do you turn around this juggernaut?
Well, that's the real problem. And number one in this process is that the scientific community has spoken that corn into ethanol is simply a stupid pathway for this. There's not many other ways to sugarcoat it. There's a few places where corn is grown with low fossil fuel inputs, but essentially in this country we've optimized corn to be as fossil fuel intensive as possible because fossil fuel prices have been kept somewhat artificially low and we reward farmers. So removing the subsidies for doing business as usual is step one, but the broader message here is that there's a new kind of accounting we need to do, which is called life cycle, or cradle to grave and back into the cradle. And if you want to think about any new energy system, whether it's solar panels or biofuels, you need to do that accounting. And the U.S. and some of the European agricultural lobbies are not. They are just looking at profit from converting lands, irrespective of what the carbon damage is or what the damage is to poor communities anywhere on Earth.
Mm-hmm. You have any feelings about that? How are we going to turn this juggernaut around, Dave?
Well, I think I guess my normal response to biofuels is that I want us to not us but the world to find ways to make them that do provide energy and environmental benefits, and to make them something that bright entrepreneurial people can go out, produce, and get a lot of wealth from. And I think that what we're going to see in the next generation of biofuels, the ones that aren't based upon food, is that when those that technology is made efficient and when they're using the right feedstocks, and I agree with Dan Kamen that we should be using waste products first, when that happens, I think the result in biofuels is going to be cheaper than corn ethanol, and a very simple market force will take place.
Dan,
we'll quit buying corn ethanol.
Dave, you could not have done my lead-in better for me, because when we come back from the break, we're going to start talking about some of the other better possible sources of biofuels. We're going to talk about algae, and we're going to talk about bacteria that can turn waste into biofuels. Stay with us. We'll be back and see what else there is besides these food sources for fuels. Don't go away. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about alternatives to biofuels from growing crops. What are the other alternatives? And there's one really interesting alternative that is a plant that grows in the ground. You can find it just about everywhere. It grows in the oceans and water. And I'm talking about algae. And according to algae experts, it's an almost perfect energy producer. One company says that they can yield a fuel that is 100 times more efficient than corn and use just 1% of the water it takes to make the same amount of fuel. Joining me now to talk more about using algae to make fuel is Harrison Dillon. He is the president and chief technology officer of Solazyme Incorporated. He joins us from San Francisco. Thanks for being with us today, Mr. Dillon.
Thank you, Ira. It's good to be here.
Tell us why algae. Very few people have heard of using algae to make fuel. How do you do that? Why is it better?
Well, you know, a little history I think is instructive. Algae were producing oil on Earth billions of years ago. They're the most efficient oil producers on the planet. In fact, the last time you filled up your gas tank, you were buying what was fossilized algae. That's where oil comes from. And that process takes about, you know, roughly 100 million years, give or take. And what we do at Solazyme is we actually use, you know, modern biotechnology to compress that 100 million year process into the course of a few days. And we do it by taking agricultural waste products, so wood chips, switchgrass, cellulosic products, also industrial chemical waste, things that are either just thrown away or burned, and we feed those to the algae, and we do it in a way where it optimizes the efficiency of the oil production biochemistry inside the algae to the point where they're doing nothing but just taking what we're feeding them and turning that into oil very efficiently. And then we take that oil and we can turn it into a number of different transportation fuels, so biodiesel, another fuel called renewable diesel, renewable jet fuel. We can turn the oil into just about anything that you can you can use from a regular Boss barrel of oil. So the things under your sink, the cleaning supplies, industrial chemicals, what comes out of a barrel of oil, we can make renewably by using our algae technology.
And how soon can you make this for us? And how big can you make it?
Well, we're producing thousands of gallons of this fuel today. In fact, we were recently featured in a biofuel documentary that it actually appeared at the Sundance Film Festival, and it won the documentary competition. And in that film, we're driving a car all over the San Francisco Bay Area on fuel that we made from algae. So the fuel, at least from Solazyme, is here today. And in terms of how big it could get, it could get very, very big. We use, you know, these waste products, you know, non-food feedstocks that are available in large quantities. So this could become a significant proportion of the transportation fuel that's out there today.
Well, how do you take on the big oil companies then, or do you get bought up by them?
Well, I think that there's a first of all, let me tell you one thing. We just recently closed a deal with Chevron on our diesel fuel, and I'll explain why we did that. I can't talk about the details of the agreement, but there's about somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 trillion worth of investment in the existing energy infrastructure out there, from pipelines to oil refineries to gas stations to cars. And if you want these fuels to be adopted and adopted quickly so that they'll make a real difference in our carbon emissions, you need to make fuels that are compatible with the existing infrastructure that's already out there. So you don't need to modify a car to use our fuels, and our fuels can go through that existing infrastructure. And so, you know, these fuels, they're not going to put big oil out of business, and in fact, we actually need those companies because no one's going to finance the duplication of new energy transportation and distribution infrastructure. So these biofuels will become a real part of the solution, but oil companies are not going to go away.
Mm-hmm. I also noticed that General Motors is also buying up an ethanol-producing company. We're going to talk to them later in the program, or at least taking a share, not buying up, taking a share of them. What's to prevent a big oil producer who's getting 100, you know, ExxonMobil made $50 billion in oil last year. Why should they not buy you up and put you on a shelf someplace so that you don't compete with them for this kind of money?
I know there are conspiracy theories out there. I can tell you from firsthand experience that oil companies have a lot of money, but they don't part with it lightly, and they expect a return on their investment. And, you know, the reality, let me give you an example about putting it on the shelf. We make a light sweet crude oil from algae. It's an extremely high quality light sweet crude oil. And as oil supplies go down, we've already burned the best, lightest oil out there. And so when you have new incoming oil from a new oil field into a refinery that's very heavy, and it's a lot heavier than what was being processed before, it costs literally billions of dollars to retrofit the refinery. Now, the refinery has to be taken offline, and those billions get passed on to customers. So with our technology, which you can place anywhere geographically, you can actually put our light sweet crude oil technology directly at an oil refinery and produce a very high quality oil that you can then blend with a much heavier grade of crude that's coming in and avoid having to upgrade that refinery to take a heavier grade of oil. So and that's great because that expenditure doesn't have to happen, and it also starts introducing these totally renewable biofuels into the existing infrastructure for making fuel. So,
but how much of a dent can you make in the petroleum-based industries?
I think it's a significant dent.
Mm-hmm. Give us a number.
A lot of technology.
Give us a number. How much of a dent?
I think a very, you know, certainly without question, you know, double-digit percentages of what's being burned. Now, this takes a lot of money, and it takes years to ramp this up. The scale in which these fuels are produced, it's gargantuan. And the biotechnology industry is used to making things on a smaller scale. So it takes time to scale up. But the oil companies know that they need solutions.
Mm-hmm. And how cheaply can you make a gallon of diesel fuel?
Well, we believe that within 2 years, possibly three, we'll be at economic parity with fossil-based transportation fuel. We've made enormous progress at bringing the cost of these fuels down. And let me point out one other thing regarding the carbon footprint of this stuff. The fuels that we produce at Solazyme and the feedstocks that we use, fuels that do not compete with food sources, so our technology doesn't depend on food, and they also have a much higher energy density than for example ethanol, and you can take our fuels and put them into things like the tractors and the trucks and the locomotives that move all these materials around. So these fuels that we're producing today, next-generation fuels, are really a much better alternative than, say, corn ethanol or soybean or palm-based biodiesel. Those are the first-generation biofuels. It's great that they've been produced. Those alter land use in a big way. They compete with food prices. Our technology doesn't do that. So I want to make that point because, as I understand, I haven't seen these papers, but I understand that there are some new papers that have been released.
Yes, we've been talking about them this hour, about the problems with using corn-based or palm oil or other food crops.
I think if you talk to next generation biofuel companies like Solazyme, I think we all know that those competing with food or doing ripping out rainforest to plant palm plantations, it's not a good idea. And I think people in companies like mine recognize that.
And you can put your plants any place. They can be your.
You can put our plants really anywhere on the world. There's a video that shows our production technology and how it works that's been posted on the Science Friday website.
Yes, there
is. Your listeners have some questions. They can look at that video and see how it works. You can locate this technology anywhere.
All right. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us. I know you have to go, Harrison. So thanks a lot for. It's very fascinating, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Ira.
Harrison Dillon is the Chief Technology Officer of Solazyme Incorporated, and he was on the line from San Francisco with us. Back with us also is Dan Kamen and David Tillman. What do you think about algae?
Well,
Dan?
There's some issues. I mean, the idea that algae could be a player is real. Some of the benefits are you can grow a great deal more of it per unit volume and even in some cases per unit energy input. Algae is pretty resilient. It's been around for billions of years. And so there's a real possibility here. There are some technical hurdles. It looks like we are going to almost certainly be genetically modifying various bacteria to make it, which brings up the GMO issue. And while a very attractive route is to put tanks of this algae right at current fossil fuel power plants and actually to use the warm carbon dioxide gas as a feedstock, which is a way to also sequester that CO2, that's very attractive. Whether this can really ramp up to be a big player because of the infrastructure involved, because this is a system that is going to have to, as you were describing, get into our energy economy. That's going to be tricky. And so what California's done is to pass a low-carbon fuel standard that Governor Schwarzenegger signed last January. And what that says is that we're going to rate all our fuels based on this greenhouse gas impact. And so these algae fuels do have a role in there. The real question is which of these get ramped up, and can we also evolve this low-carbon fuel standard into one that I would call a sustainable fuel standard? Because carbon is one of the issues, but we're also talking about demand on water and what happens to surrounding soils and could the GM crops actually get out? There's a variety of things that are going to have to be built into a better standard. How far we can push the oil industry with high prices is, I think, where the conspiracy theories may actually have a little bit of footing.
There's a company called Green Fuels, which is also another algae producing company, and they have experimenting with a couple of places. They did one in Phoenix, a power plant in Phoenix, a gas powered power plant. Well, they've shown that their algae installed basically in a greenhouse next door to the plant where they feed the exhaust gas with CO2 can take out a really significant amount of CO2 out of the smokestacks.
That's right. I mean, it looks very attractive. You know, the issue for all of these fuels is scaling them up. Mm-hmm. And there's no question that there are going to be some companies that make a lot of money. And the question is, do we just get a kind of a green chic, or do we actually cut into that fossil fuel equation, which we now know everywhere is going to have to become part of our new calculus for thinking about the planet? And whether we just get the green companies or whether we actually reduce fossil fuel demand, that's really unclear for these technologies yet, but it's a good start.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, taking calls and actually questions also in Second Life. Let's go to a Second Life question. Hi,
Ira. This is Aquiel from Second Life. I'm really from Michigan, and my question has to do, are other grasses as good as switchgrass? And I'm thinking particularly of prairie grasses. There's a lot of prairie grass in the Middle West that could be used.
Dave Tillman?
Yes. Yeah, switchgrass is a fabulous plant, but other grasses, a big blue stem, little blue stem, another one called Indian grass, depending upon the soil, they're actually better than switchgrass. And what we found in a paper we published in Science just about a year ago is there's a step beyond just growing a monoculture. We found that when we put a mixture of these productive prairie grasses in with a mixture of prairie legumes and some other prairie plants, that those mixtures gave us much more energy per acre than did any one of those grasses, including switchgrass, growing by itself. And they also stored more carbon in the soil than did switchgrass by itself or any of the other plants by themselves. So it might be a route toward almost restoring prairie on degraded land to a high diversity mixture of species, but biased toward these very productive grasses and legumes, that combination may prove to be a very good way both to store carbon in the soil and give a better greenhouse gas signature for the fuel and to get a lot more energy per acre without having to fertilize and use pesticides and so on.
Talking about alternative fuel choice of this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, talking with Dave Tillman and Dan Kamen. These grasses lock up, you say, the CO2 in the soil because of the root system there, the very underground web of root system?
Yeah, you have it. You know, people used to make houses in the old days out of sod from prairie because there were such dense, strong root systems in the prairie soil. 3/4 of the living part of a prairie plant is actually below ground. So when you see these 3 or 5 or 6 foot tall grasses, think about 3 times more than that being below ground. And as they build roots every year, roots always die and grow and die. And when they die, some of the biomass in them doesn't decay at all quickly, and it builds up through time. In fact, those plants are the plants that made these fertile soils in the prairie in the first place, that gave us the land, that gives us our corn, our wheat, and so on. And we lose a lot of that carbon when we farm it, but if you plant this abandoned land back with the same plants that made the soil in the first place, they'll build that carbon back up in the soil as they live their lives and can give a big greenhouse gas advantage because of that.
Let's go to Hugh in Oakland. Hi, Hugh.
Hi, how are you? I have 2 questions. The first is, there's an existing certification to prevent old growth forests from being used, and that's in the lumber industry, the FSC certification. Could it be piggybacked or expanded to include fuels? And I have a second question I can ask now or later.
Later, because we may run out of time. Dan?
Well, you certainly could. You know, we haven't done so great in terms of protecting old-growth forests when there was a real big financial incentive to cut them down. Pacific Lumber and others have a pretty difficult record. You could do this. The main worry, though, isn't really protecting old-growth forests in the U.S. It's the much more chaotic world of all of the developing country settings and tracking what happens when a hectare of land goes from corn or soy in Kansas into biofuel production. It doesn't immediately pop up as another hectare of land that you can just track with sort of points on a map the next day over in Brazil or Indonesia. It's a much more convoluted process. And the worry is that unless we really get serious about the broader climate story, installing a cost for carbon and certifying sustainable and unsustainable projects, sort of life cycle idea around carbon, that these are going to be very hard to track even if the intentions of some managers are good. And so it's a very hard one to do because land use is there's lots of ways to disguise what's going on, whether it's intentional or not. And so this life cycle assessment, valuing, and kind of quantifying our fuels is going to need to be the part of the process. And thankfully, we do have other states, in addition to California and Germany and the UK, working towards these standards. But doing it in practice is a real challenge.
All right. We have to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk lots more with Dave Tillman, professor of ecology, University of Minnesota, Dan Kamen, professor of energy at UC Berkeley. We're also going to bring on another player in this little play about the alternative energies today. We're going to talk also with Coscata Incorporated, another company that has been using microbes to process garbage. We got a lot of waste. Why not turn the garbage into fuel? They do it. We'll talk about how they do it after this break. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about trying to find more perfect fuels for biofuels than corn or soybeans or any of the crops we plant that we compete with for food. And now that we're discovering from research published this week, may actually be doing more harm than good in terms of releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere instead of trying to lock more of it up. Well, what better perfect fuel could there be than fuel that we make out of garbage, out of stuff we would throw out? Things like old tires, diapers, household garbage or industrial waste. Joining me now to talk about his company that is doing that is my guest, Wes Bolson, Chief Marketing Officer and Vice President of Business Development for Coscata Incorporated. He joins us by phone from Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday, Mr. Bolson.
Thank you for having me today.
How do you make ethanol out of all these things?
Well, it's a good question. It's really a pretty simple three-step process, and that's what makes it available and viable today. The front end is called gasification. Something that's been around for more than 100 years. It's what we used to do for town gas. And so whether it's trash or agricultural residues or shredded tires, really it's just like it sounds. The first step in the process is turning it in, you know, almost decomposing it into its chemical elements, carbon monoxide, hydrogen, carbon dioxide. And then the really special piece is these microorganisms that are able to really breathe in, if you will, this synthesis gas or this carbon monoxide and hydrogen-rich stream, and then they exhale or produce ethanol. And so it's these are naturally occurring, non-genetically modified, yet very hard to find microorganisms producing the ethanol.
And how good are they at doing this?
Oh, I mean, it's fantastic. I think one of our partners used the word gluttonous bugs. I mean, these things seek out almost all of the chemical energy in the carbon monoxide and hydrogen, can make as much as 100 gallons of fuel from 1 ton of dry material.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, if you...
What else is left over?
So really, once you do the front-end gasification, you're dealing with a gas all the way through, and the bugs eat the chemical energy and the remaining gas you use to burn, and it's above the lower flammable limit. To be able to do the distillation or the ethanol separation. We have a couple of patents on the back end as well for ethanol separation. And so really it's efficient through the whole process, including the bugs. So.
And the bugs, are they bacteria?
Yeah, they're Clostridia-based bacteria. Scientists and researchers down at the University of Oklahoma and Oklahoma State, very difficult to find. I mean, these are some of the best in the world that find these naturally occurring organisms, and then they're sort of like children. We've taught them to produce more ethanol, and how do we feed them? What nourishment and nutrients do we give them? And since getting them out of the University of Oklahoma, we've been able to get almost 50 times the production of ethanol with our microbiologists and scientists here at Coscata.
Now, to create the initial gas, don't you have to heat up the waste products, and does that not use energy itself?
Well, there's a couple ways of doing it. You can actually use the material putting in to heat the other material. So it's you could take a hit on suppose you're putting in wood waste or something. Mm-hmm. 20-30% of the wood waste that you're putting in there goes to heating up the other material. The other alternative is to insert just a little bit of external energy. You know, whether it's a 4, 5, 6% of electricity or something of the total amount of energy. and then you don't have to burn the actual material. And really that becomes an economic question. Mm-hmm. Do you want to burn the material to heat it up, or do you want to use a little bit of external energy to do this?
Mm-hmm. Well, just this week at the Chicago Auto Show, General Motors announced a partnership with you, correct?
That is correct. We actually had they announced us at the centerpiece of the International Auto Show up in Detroit, and then GM North American President Troy Clark announced that, you know, GM wants to be a leader in this market.
They want to create ethanol.
They are going to do it from two ends. They may not own the plants. What they're saying is we're going to put 50% of our cars. You know, it's kind of the chicken and egg. Mm-hmm. GM is taking a leadership role and saying 50% of our vehicles will be ethanol capable, you know, flex fuel capable in the next 5 years. We're going to get the cars on the road, and then what they did is they said, you know, not only do we want next generation ethanol on the market, we believe Coscata is ready today, and we're going to make a strategic investment in this company to make sure we rapidly commercialize this technology to get ethanol on the, you know, on the market.
That's a lot of cars. Can you make enough ethanol for them, for their cars?
That's the great part, is when you have this really efficient process that uses you know, multiple input materials. And that's one of the benefits is the multiple input materials, the flexibility we have on the front end. You know, we hope to make billions and billions of gallons of ethanol and really have a true impact on our use of oil.
Mm-hmm. And how much a gallon would that come to?
Well, what we're looking at is the production cost of ethanol being under $1 a gallon. That compares to, you know, approximately $2 a gallon production cost of gasoline today.
Mm-hmm.
So we're approximately half the cost of gasoline production, and then, you know, you have markups and transportation costs and capital recoveries and different pieces that have to be put in there. But what we're looking at is, you know, producing ethanol for under $1 a gallon to really change the whole equation. We can do, you know, wonderful things for the environment, reducing greenhouse gases, while we're also putting economical fuel on the market.
But you're going to have to make tens of millions of gallons.
Billions would be. We have a 36 billion gallon renewable fuel standard the president signed, and they want 21 billion of those gallons to come from non-food-based sources. So you could say that the market opportunity for Coscata is as much as 21 billion gallons.
Mm-hmm. How are you going to compete with other folks like
this? Oh, I look at it as these are partners. I mean, when the goal of our industry is to reduce our dependence on oil, I look at the other people in our industry as almost partners in reducing oil dependence. It's a big enough market for a lot of different players. Mm-hmm. It'd be foolish to say Coscata can capture all of that.
Now, we had Solazyme on, and I asked them, I'm going to ask you the same question. How do you know that they're not going to just invest in your company and then put you on a shelf someplace? I mean, oil is $100 a barrel. Why should they want $2 or $1 alcohol?
Well, I mean, what you have, you're right. There's people out there, and that's that conspiracy theory, as I've heard someone call it before. But you know, when you get partners like General Motors, you know, so the partnerships, the people who are making strategic investments for the future of Coscata, are people like General Motors who are, you know, putting the cars on the market and truly want ethanol. There's no desire to shelf this technology. The desire is to rapidly commercialize it, and you find other partners who are going to do this, and it may be and could be outside of the current oil players.
All right, let me bring in my other guests, Dan Kamen. What's your reaction to this?
Well, I'm really excited about these technologies. I mean, I think that getting the waste stream to be part of our resource stream is very exciting, and I think this is actually a very promising technology. We need to support these. In fact, we have a very large research contract with BP, a $500 million effort to do it. But I think you heard in the answer what the worry is, and that was that while the current policy standard in this country calls for this 35 billion gallons, and since this 21 billion gallons cleaner fuel, that also calls for 15 billion gallons of corn ethanol. That does compete with food, and what both Dave Tillman's paper and Tim Serchinger's paper shows is that if you get a reasonable benefit of these new fuels like Coscata's, but you get a huge negative hit because you're converting rainforest and this indirect land use is really making your overall biofuel mixture very ugly for the planet, that's an equation that unless our policy tools are very strong, like a low-carbon fuel standard, a carbon tax, et cetera, we are going to get some neat new clean industries. And I love Cascada to be a big deal. I wish they'd offer me a spot on their board kind of thing. But we will be also growing what is proving to be a very destructive to the climate and to local communities, corn and soy-based ethanol industry. And cutting that out is a major, major problem. Mm-hmm.
Dan, what do you mean by a low-carbon fuel standard?
So what California passed was to note the amount of carbon, not just in a gallon of gasoline when you burn it, but the whole life cycle. It takes carbon, takes energy, which we usually get from carbon, to run the tractors, to distill the corn material into fuel. So what California said is we don't want to pick individual winners. We don't want to give a fixed contract to a certain company. What we want to do instead is to have a standard and everyone must beat it. And so what California has done, and again, the governor signed this back in January, a year ago now, was to say by 2010, our fuel mix must be 10% less carbon intensive than it is today or more. And so as new technologies like Cascada and Solzyme come online, we in the policy, science policy analysis world will try to bring down those standards to drive out the environmentally and socially bad fuels and reward those like Cascada for being good environmental citizens as well as making a real business sector profit. And that's the challenge because, well, we talk about these green fuels and they will have a share, and I believe these companies will do well. As of last count, and Dave Tillman may have a better count, of the 125 or so ethanol distilleries being rapidly built in this country, 90% of them are corn-based. And so building out this clean sector is going to be working against just as big as incumbent as the emerging solar and wind and geothermal sectors have to contend with in terms of the big fossil fuel giants. So how to clean that.
But Wes Balson, you have an 800-pound gorilla on your side.
Well, we're happy to have General Motors as our partner, and what we want to do is continue to put this fuel out there. In fact, Argonne National Labs just did an independent study saying, Cascada well-to-wheel analysis is what they call it. It's what these guys are talking about. Dan and Dave are talking about is, full cradle-to-grave or life cycle analysis. Dr. Michael Wang and his team do a fantastic job. And they said, look, Cascada reduces greenhouse gas emissions by as much as 84%. Using this technology because it's so efficient with the organisms and the input material that we have.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about alternative fuels this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato. So are you envisioning, Wes, that when the recycle trucks and the garbage trucks come up to my home every week, that they don't head to the dump? Or they go right to your plant that will turn it into some sort of biofuel?
Well, not exactly, because there's a lot of recyclables. We don't do the best job in our houses sorting out our trash. You're putting glass bottles and metal, and people throw their batteries in there, and there's just some things that we could do to sort our trash a little bit better. What Cascada does is looks at the organic material. If it can't turn into a gas, if you think about it, if you heat it up real hot and it melts, that doesn't work very well for us. What you do is, we love the organic material of, like we say, the diapers, rubber shredded tires,
right.
Plastics are wonderful, and plastics just sit in the landfill and don't really decompose well at all.
Mm-hmm.
So we could reduce a large percentage or almost all of what goes into a landfill, allowing the other stuff to be recycled.
Mm-hmm. Dan, we have a couple of minutes left, but I want to ask you a philosophical question here. A lot of these questions we're asking about biofuels, which ones emit more carbon, which ones are better for the environment. We never ever considered asking these questions of fossil fuels, did we?
No, we didn't. We were in a rush to industrialize, and now we're discovering the downside because humans are now a significant ecological impact. There's a famous and really wonderful paper done by a group at Stanford, headed by an ecologist, Peter Vitusek, that estimated that humans impact, directly or indirectly, 40% of all the biological activity called the net primary productivity, and that we appropriate and use more than 10%. And that's not sustainable even if carbon wasn't our only metric, rivers, biodiversity, et cetera. So coming up with standards that we can enforce to make sure that waste gets used first and to make sure that we don't compete with food sound good, and you can write them down in meetings, but competing them into the market so that they become really the new language is going to be a real challenge. And I think actually, thankfully, we've got three presidential candidates remaining, all of whom are leaders and quite expert in this area. So I'm pretty hopeful that after 8 years in the doldrums, we'll actually get this going. But it's a real, real challenge.
Dave Tillman, are you optimistic? I know a bunch of scientists have signed a letter sending it to Nancy Pelosi in Congress.
Yeah, I am optimistic. I think that the research that's coming out now and the incredible entrepreneurial spirit that we see out there in developing new biofuels, I think we're going to find ways to greatly reduce the greenhouse gas impact of our transportation. I want to add just one other thing, which I think we all know, besides biofuel. Biofuel is going to be maybe a 20% solution to our energy needs for transportation. But we can do at least that amount by increasing the efficiency of the vehicles that we have and the efficiency of our whole transportation network. So I think in the long term, we have to be looking at all aspects of the system. And one final comment, I really agree very strongly with Dan. We have to have a way that we evaluate each fuel and find out what its true life cycle impacts are and then reward those that give us benefits. If we don't reward the companies that are doing it right and give us those fuels, we won't be able to get their products onto the marketplace and have the services that we need from them.
So we need new kinds of measurement standards.
Absolutely. New measurement standards, and we need to have those tied in some direct way, like this low-carbon fuel standard that Dan Kamen has been talking about, have those dictate what kinds of fuels really can be sold at the gas pump. It's the easiest way to do it, and it just tells the industry ahead of time, you've got a plan to make a fuel however you can that will reduce greenhouse gases by this amount in this year.
Well, maybe if we ever get to a science debate 2008, we'll be able to actually ask the candidates where they stand on this.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Dave Tillman, Professor of Ecology, University of Minnesota. Dan Kamen, Professor of Energy, University of California, Berkeley. Also co-director of the Berkeley Institute of the Environment. And also Wes Bolson, Chief Marketing Officer and Vice President of Business Development for Coscata Incorporated. That's all the time we have for this hour. Our program is produced by Karen Vergoth and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Shubin Ma is our Metcalf Fellow. And Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. If you missed any of the stuff we talked about today, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We've got the links up there for the web spots we talked about. Also, we're podcasting and blogging, and folks in Second Life, if you'd like to join them, you can just click on the little Second Life slurl that we have up there on Science Friday. Also, you can send us email and leave your comments and suggestions for Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.